Secretary of State Antony Blinken says time is running out for Iran to, quote, return to the 2015 nuclear deal. Israel deploys more forces in the occupied West Bank as part of the regime's attempt to capture six Palestinians who escaped an Israeli jail. Also ahead, Afghanistan's new acting prime minister says former officials who fled when the Taliban seized power will be safe if they return to the country. Welcome to World News. We're live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you very much for joining us. Also, this hour, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says time is running out for Iran to, quote, return to the 2015 nuclear deal. He made the remarks after the International Atomic Energy Agency accused Tehran of lack of cooperation. For more on that, earlier we were joined by our guests in the News Review program.
Welcome everyone to News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. And now the U.S. Secretary of State says that time is running out for Iran to return to the nuclear deal.
I'm not going to put a date on it, but we are getting closer to the point at which a strict return to compliance with the JCPOA does not reproduce the benefits that that agreement achieved.
Antony Blinken's remarks come after the International Atomic Energy Agency released a strongly worded report Tuesday criticizing what it called Tehran's lack of cooperation. A day after the IAEA report, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said that his country has been transparent about its nuclear activities. Raisi also stressed that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is sticking to its predecessor's policy of sanctions and pressure against Iran. Washington unilaterally withdrew from the accord back in May of 2018. Iran wants the U.S. to remove all sanctions in a verifiable manner and assure that it will not exit the deal again. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Michael Springman, author and former U.S. diplomat, joining us from Washington, D.C., and Mr. Don DeBar, journalist and political commentator, joining us out of New York. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. I guess, Michael, we'll start with you in the U.S. Capitol. Your thoughts about Antony Blinken saying that time is running out for Iran to get back in the deal?
Well, it's the same old story. The United States withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, trashing it, and the European so-called allies that were part of the deal, Germany, France, and the United Kingdom, they supported the Americans, refused to pressure the Americans, but in turn, refused to cooperate with Iran and sell them and buy from them any kinds of goods or services. We've got the Americans refusing to pressure Israel, which has atomic weapons, Pakistan, which have the same, the Indians, which have nuclear weapons, but somehow it's always Iran. And in fact, the President Biden appointed Dan Shapiro, a former ambassador to Israel, as a special representative to Israel for Iran and presumably Iranian policy. So it's basically the Zionists calling the tune in Washington, D.C.
Thank you, Michael. And Mr. Don DeBar, I'd like to welcome you to the program. Sir, I saw you shaking your head. Your initial thoughts on the story?
It's so hard because there's so much that's missing from the narrative that is necessary to understand what's going on. The IAEA, for example, is a creature of some treaties that were supposed to result in nuclear disarmament about 50 years ago. And the United States has failed to pursue that, actually in violation of the treaty that enables the existence of the IAEA. That's one piece of content. Another is that the United States has sanctioned Iran since its revolution, where it overthrew a puppet government installed by the United States, by the CIA in 1953, and has intensified those sanctions and has been conducting all types of warfare, with the exception of an actual invasion, since 1979. Iran is perfectly entitled to develop whatever weapon systems it needs to defend itself, has never threatened any of its neighbors, and has not pursued a nuclear weapons program, even though it was entitled to. The United States held out the possibility of allowing Iran re-entry into the global economy, which is an absurdity all by itself, that the U.S. should have the power and the right to do this. And then as Iran traded away its right to build a certain type of weapons that it wasn't building anyway, the U.S. yanked the rug out from under the agreement and declared that it was abrogated. That's the agreement now that the IAEA says Iran is not living up to, but there are no other parties that are actually involved in it of any consequence. Without the U.S., it's a meaningless treaty. And the very same agency and the very same director general of that agency that's issued this report about Iran, when issuing a general statement back in June, when after, by coincidence for some reason, after discussing all 173 members more or less in some detail, only these three adversaries of the U.S., Iran, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, North Korea, and Syria, which the U.S. has been conducting a war against for the past 10 years. It's not hard to see what with doing the arithmetic, that the IAEA is acting as a puppet but you have both the director general there winking at the violations by the U.S. without mentioning them. You have Blinken, of course, issuing this statement, and then President Nod in the White House, who's obviously sleeping through all of this stuff, and will ultimately threaten Iran with this or that sanctions. Background, one more item, of course, is that 6 months into Trump's term, the U.S. Congress showed him that even if he wanted to make peace with Iran or North Korea, that he was not going to be permitted to remove sanctions against them or Russia with an act that they passed in July of 2017, almost unanimously across both houses. I think there were 7 dissenting votes and more than 500 in favor. So the U.S. government is at war with Iran, North Korea, Syria, and a half a dozen other countries in the world, and the IAEA is acting as a coat for the U.S. to go out and pretend that it's a friendly little furry bear or something. I don't know. I have to laugh when I see this stuff.
Gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. It was a pleasure. Mr. Michael Springman from Washington, D.C., and Mr. Don DeBar, they're joining us out of New York. That's a wrap for the segment of your News Review program. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
Iran's permanent representative to the United Nations says nuclear disarmament must remain a top priority for the world. Majid Takhtravanchi urged the international community to press nuclear weapon states to fulfill their legal obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iranian diplomats singled out the United States for having conducted over 1,000 nuclear tests since 1945. He also said Israel's possession of weapons of mass destruction and its threats to use them must not be tolerated. Takhtravanchi made the remarks at the high-level plenary meeting of the UN General Assembly on the International Day Against Nuclear Tests. Palestinians rally in the occupied West Bank in support of prisoners in Israeli jails as the regime imposes new restrictions on inmates. Israeli forces attacked the demonstrators, injuring 100 Palestinians. Many Palestinian inmates also protested the regime's repressive actions. Israel's boosting of prison security comes after 6 Palestinian men broke out of a maximum security jail this week. The regime flooded the occupied territories with troops in a massive manhunt operation. Israel deployed drones and an army mission to Jenin, the hometown of many of the escapees. Israeli troops also arrested several relatives of escaped Palestinians. The 6 staged their jailbreak through a hole they had dug under a sink in a prison cell, reportedly using a spoon. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent Muna Kandil in the occupied West Bank. She gave us more details about the latest Palestinian protests against Israeli crackdown on Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinians had demonstrated in several areas of the occupied West Bank, in Nablus, in Jenin, in Beit Lahem, in Ariha, also known as Jericho, in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, and in Ramallah, as well. Demonstrations have taken place to the areas where Israeli military checkpoints are located, and Palestinians have clashed with the Israeli forces. In Nablus, for example, and mainly in the village of Beita, as well as at the checkpoint of Hawara, south Nablus, Palestinians had clashed with the Israeli forces. We are speaking about 100 Palestinians had been wounded during the night demonstrations that had taken place in support of the Palestinian prisoners. Also in Al-Khalil, known as Hebron, dozens of Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces, who fired heavy tear gas and stun grenades, as well as rubber-coated bullets, in order to disperse the protesters in Ramallah, at the military checkpoint of Beit Eil. Also, similar clashes have taken place between the Israeli forces and Palestinian protesters.
Moving on to the latest developments in Afghanistan, the president of the International Committee of the Red Cross says the country needs more humanitarian support, stressing that people are suffering from psychological and physical harm.
I talk about, of course, the women, the children, the displaced, those detained, those released from detention and suffering from psychological and physical harm. These are all issues which were discussed in our conversations with the authorities, local as well as national, and which will be part of ICRC's hopefully increased and fastened response to the needs in Afghanistan.
Peter Mara made the comment following a four-day trip to Afghanistan, where he met with Taliban leaders. He also warned of a looming danger of collapse of the country's health system, adding that it should be a critical priority. Mara said the crisis in Afghanistan is so deep and long-lasting that a collective international responsibility is needed to help. The ICRC chief noted the agency is engaging with the country's new Taliban leadership. He said the new government has expressed its willingness for the ICRC to continue working in Afghanistan. And Afghanistan's acting prime minister has called on former government officials to return to the country. In an interview with Al Jazeera, Mullah Muhammad Hassan Akhund promised amnesty for anyone who's worked alongside the United States and the former pro-US government. Akhund also said that the caretaker government would guarantee the security of diplomats, embassies, and humanitarian organizations. He added that the Taliban seek positive and strong relations with the world. The comments came a day after the Taliban announced their interim government.
Almost 3 weeks after the fall of Kabul to the Taliban, and only a few days after the group's spokesman declared victory of Panjshir clash, the Taliban announced the lineup of its caretaker government.
Mohtaram Al-Haj Muhammad Hassan Akhund has been appointed as the acting prime minister. Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar and Maulavi Abdus Salam Hanafi will serve as his deputies. Maulavi Muhammad Yaqub Mujahid and Al-Haj Mullah Sirajuddin Haqqani are also appointed as the acting defense and interior ministers. Maulavi Amir Khan Muttaqi serves as acting foreign minister of the caretaker government.
The declaration of the caretaker government of Taliban has sparked mixed reactions inside and abroad. Many have criticized the Taliban for not forming an inclusive government. They, for instance, argue that all members of the newly declared acting cabinet ministers are Taliban figures. Moreover, the absence of women in Taliban's caretaker government is considered as one of the other causes behind rising criticism among Afghans, especially women.
In protest to the lineup of Taliban's caretaker government, Afghan women took to the streets of Kabul and voiced their anger at the absence of women and the newly declared cabinet ministers.
Despite this, Taliban officials insist that they are fully committed to respect and even protect women's rights. They also said will declare an inclusive government that will remove all current public concerns and criticisms.
Our country is facing numerous challenges, mainly poverty. Furthermore, the country has just left behind a crisis. Now security is restored to all parts of the country. So we declared this caretaker government to manage the urgent in a better way. We will, of course, declare an inclusive government soon.
We want security and don't care who brings it to us. If they are right, the Taliban must help us go back to our village in northeastern Badakhshan. I also ask the Taliban to avoid any further violence in the country by establishing an inclusive government.
Besides local reactions to the declaration of Taliban's government, some states, including China and Uzbekistan, have welcomed this recent move of Taliban in terms of declaring and acting cabinet ministers. Some other countries, however, insist that the only legitimate government in Afghanistan will be the one which must take power based on the will of the people of Afghanistan. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The World Health Organization has called on countries to avoid giving out a third COVID jabs until year end, pointing to the millions worldwide who have yet to receive a single dose.
Today, I'm calling for an extension of the moratorium until at least the end of the year to enable every country to vaccinate at least 40% of its population.
Tedros urged wealthy countries and vaccine makers to prioritize getting the first jabs to health workers and vulnerable populations in poorer nations over boosters. He said widespread use of boosters for healthy people who are fully vaccinated is not necessary. Tedros added that high-income countries had promised to donate more than 1 billion vaccine doses to poorer countries, but less than 15% of those doses have so far materialized. And that brings an end to our bulletin for this hour, but don't go away.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
The limelight.
Zionist regime officers wounded the detainees, terrorized them, and whomever dared to lift his head upwards risked more beatings by officers. According to affidavits, the floor of the room was covered in blood from the beatings. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jessica Boxbaum Ryder. This article is published under the heading Palestinian protesters recount harrowing details of torture at the hands of Israeli regime police. In May, the world watched the Zionist regime's brutal occupation on full display. The forcible displacement of Sheikh Jarrah residents was underway. The Zionist regime's security forces attacked Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan. The Israeli regime rocket fire rained down on Gaza, and Jewish extremists chanted death to Arabs in the streets. According to multiple testimonies, the Zionist regime police in Nazareth ran a torture room where they ruthlessly attacked Palestinian detainees during the wave of demonstrations against the Zionist regime in May. Now, as international headlines fade on Palestine, the Israeli regime violence continues. Faiz Zobedat was talking on the phone about 20 feet away from a protest in Nazareth. The moment the 21-year-old student hung up the phone, the Israeli regime police threw a stun grenade into the street. An officer then charged at him and punched him in the nose. Zubaydat was soon encircled by police who grabbed him, hit him, and pushed him toward a border police officer who tried to slam his head against a wall. "I asked why they were hitting me when I am not resisting," Zubaydat said, adding, "I put my hands behind my back even though they didn't handcuff me. Nevertheless, the same border police officer hit me in the nose with the walkie-talkie that he was holding." The officers dragged Zubaydat by his head to the police station, beating him along the way. On the way, we met a policeman who appeared to be an officer and started laughing and said to them, "Did you only arrest him? That's not enough. We need more," Zubaydat said. The beating continued inside the police station. Cops kicked, slapped, and hit detainees with batons, laughing as they struck them. Zubaydat detailed how one officer smacked detainees with an M16 rifle. He watched as one man with a broken nose, face covered in blood, was continuously hit by officers. Then Zubaydat described his own treatment. "A police officer approached me and whispered in my ear, threatening me. He cursed my mother, my sister, and my wife. He then asked, 'Did you understand?' I didn't answer, and he immediately slapped me in the face. He asked me again, 'Do you understand?' I still didn't answer, and he slapped me again in the face. Finally, he said, 'Go explain to your friends.' He pushed me back down to the floor and hit me again." Zubaydat's violent detention in May is one of many such, according to Adala, the legal center for Arab minority rights in the occupied territories. The advocacy group collected multiple sworn affidavits attesting to the abuse of Palestinian protesters by the Zionist regime officers, attorneys, bystanders, and children inside Nazareth police station from May 9th to May 14th. The majority of the violent arrests and most of the abuse were conducted by the Zionist regime special forces, including undercover Mistavarim, counter-terror units within the Israeli regime army border police and the Zionist regime police, officers pretending to be Palestinians. Adala submitted a complaint to the Zionist regime attorney general and the chairman of the police investigation department on June 7th. In their letter, Adala wrote, "Police officers led the detainees to a room located on the left side of the entrance corridor to the station, forcing them to sit on the floor handcuffed, to lower their heads towards the floor, and began to beat them on all parts of their bodies, using kicks and clubs, slamming their heads against walls or doors and more. Officers wounded the detainees, terrorized them, and whomever dared to lift his head upwards risked more by beatings by officers." According to the affidavits, the floor of the room was covered in blood from the beatings. Under the Zionist regime law, authorities must respond to the letter within 45 days. By Adala, attorney and co-author of the complaint, Wissam Sharaf who told Mint Press that Adala has not received a response from the Attorney General or Police Investigation Department. Adala did receive a response from Nazareth, Chief of Police, stating that he will cooperate if there is an investigation and will take the appropriate disciplinary actions. What happened inside the police station in Nazareth amounts to torture and ill treatment and requires the immediate opening of a criminal investigation to examine the circumstances and the conditions of the protesters' detention at the Nain station, including the investigation and prosecution of police officers involved in the violence, Adala attorneys wrote in their complaint. Sharaf explained that the witness and victim accounts of police brutality inside the Israeli regime police station describe activity deemed torturous under international law. What we have seen in the police station is that instead of investigating the people, the police would be the mob. The police deny the detainees in need of medical attention. That medical attention make them sign false affidavits as a condition to get medical attention. When this treatment is directed at detainees, it may amount to torture according to international law. Torture is defined under international law as intentionally inflicting severe pain or suffering in order to obtain a confession or information, intimidate or coerce the individual, or as punishment for alleged offenses. Torture is illegal and considered a war crime. In a statement to Mint Press News, the Zionist regime police said, "We emphasize that an investigation branch officer contacted the director of detention on behalf of the public defender's office and requested the presence of defense attorneys at the station. And accordingly, when the detainees arrived at the station, two defense attorneys were present to advise them. Unfortunately, some of the lawyers complaining about the appeal were at the entrance to the station, tried to create provocations on the spot. Notwithstanding the foregoing, they were periodically allowed to enter the station and tour the facility in order to prove that the detainees were being treated properly." The police spokesperson also noted that medical staff was present at the station and detainees in need of medical care were promptly treated. The Zionist regime police launched a mass arrest campaign in May, targeting Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories who participated in protests against ethnic cleansing in Sheikh Jarrah, attacks at Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the Zionist regime's assault on Gaza. The Israeli regime police arrested 2,142 individuals and filed 184 indictments during Operation Guardian of the Walls and Operation Law and Order. According to Sharaf, more than 150 Palestinians were arrested in Nazareth in May, and about 1 in 10 were indicted. Ashraf Mahroum, an attorney representing 9 people detained by police in Nazareth, said his clients and others were charged for protesting illegally, creating illegal organizations, and assaulting police officers. Mahroum's clients allege police fired rubber bullets at the upper parts of their bodies during the protest, a direct violation of the law governing use of rubber bullets. During their detention, officers struck them with batons and smacked them over the head with guns. Most of his clients' injuries were on the head and face. Some were forced to sign affidavits stating they won't disclose what happened to them in order to receive medical treatments. Evidence of similar police violence against Palestinians appeared in other cities across 1948 occupied Palestine, including in Lydd, Acca, Jaffa, and Haifa. Sharaf said, adding detainees in those localities arrived in court with visible signs of abuse. Sharaf concluded, "Adala has other testimonies about police brutality in different areas. Some of this brutality was against protesters and some of it has been inside police stations against detainees. with the systematic ill-treatment that we have witnessed from May 9th to May 14th, we can assume that more people have been subject to such kind of treatment. The Zionist Regime Security Agency, ISA, has long used torture as a standard tactic during interrogations of Palestinian residents of occupied territories. Until late 1990s, the ISA was allowed to use psychological pressure and a moderate degree of physical pressure in order to prevent terrorism, according to 1987 recommendations from a state commission. The Commission's opinion permitted the ISA to use methods of torture in their interrogations under the necessary defense clause found in the Israeli regime penal law. The Israeli regime Supreme Court banned the use of physical methods during interrogations in 1999 after a series of petitions were filed by human rights organizations and Palestinians who experienced ISA interrogations. However, the court ruled the practice of physical pressure could remain in urgent cases as part of the ticking bomb exception under the necessity defense. This legal loophole has allowed torture and ill-treatment to persist in ISA interrogations, despite the Zionist regime Justice Ministry having drafted a law to criminalize torture. According to Public Committee Against Torture in the Occupied Territories, PCATI, 1,300 complaints regarding the use of torture against Palestinian citizens in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, OPT, by the ISA have been submitted to the Ministry of Justice since 2001. These complaints resulted in only one criminal investigation and no indictments. PCATI receives dozens of complaints each year, attesting to brutality occurring during arrest, detention, interrogation, and imprisonment of Palestinians from OPT. The nonprofit organization estimates 5% to 10% of these cases amount to instances of severe torture. Severe interrogations increased sharply in 2020. In the passing year, more people were tortured in the occupied territories than in any other year in the past decade, PCATI said in their 2020 situation report on torture of Palestinians by the Israeli regime security forces. While cases of torture are prevalent within OPET, Tal Steiner, Director General of PCATI, said 1948 occupied Palestine is now experiencing an escalation of torture incidents. Steiner told Min Press PCATI has seen attributes that are usually found in the West Bank trickling into the occupied territories. There is administrative arrest, prevention of rights to seek counsel, to receive medical attention. Those are things that are quite unfortunately common in the West Bank and the occupied territories that have now become more evident within the occupied territories proper. This is not something that's usual or routine within the occupied territories for the citizens, Palestinian or not. So it's a turn for the worse. Steiner attributed this surge within historic Palestine to a culture of impunity spurred by the Zionist regime politicians like former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, explaining, when the police and military forces entered the mixed cities within the occupied territories to so-called restore the peace, then Prime Minister Netanyahu was quoted saying, go ahead and do your job and don't worry about any commission of inquiry. These types of announcements by the Prime Minister and other Israeli regime leaders can also be a reason why police officers thought they could get away with it. They can use extreme force towards citizens, demonstrators, and especially toward people from minority groups and go unpunished. On May 13th, the eve of Muslim holiday Eid al-Fitr, Nazareth resident Omar Laban was out with friends to celebrate. As he approached an ATM to withdraw money, he saw an officer decked in full riot gear running toward him. Instinctively, he began running away. The cops started throwing grenades at me, and I kept running because I knew that if I stood still, I could be badly wounded by the grenades. Laban said, while I was still running, one of the policemen raised his hand and hit me in the left eye, and I fell to the ground. Police surrounded Laban on the pavement, kicking him in the face and head. One officer pressed his boot into Laban's head and shoulder. I felt intense pain all over my body from my head to my legs. One of them started kicking me in the artery behind the ear, Laban said. At that moment, I thought I was going to die. At the police station, Laban saw detainees stuffed into a room resembling prisoners of war. They sat on the floor with their legs folded under them and heads bent. A masked officer paced around the room with a club-like object in his hand. Any detainee who lifted his head met the full swing of the officer's bat on their head. They pushed me down in the corner, and I lowered my head and curled up. Nevertheless, the same police officer hit me hard on the head with that object, Laban said. Days after his detention, Laban still felt excruciating pain throughout his body. He couldn't sleep from the dizziness. He couldn't eat without vomiting. He couldn't speak coherently. He still doesn't understand why he was arrested when he wasn't participating in any nearby protest. It was the first time I had been arrested, an arrest that I believe was illegal, pointless, and very violent, Laban said.
Food for thought.
Hello, dear friends. Today is the tragic first of the month of Safar, the day when survivors of the massacre of the Prophet's progeny at Karbala were unjustly dragged to the court of the tyrant Yazid in Damascus. Let us contemplate today and the words of the Prophet's granddaughter, Hazrat Zainab Kubra, peace be upon her, when she boldly told the tyrant Yazid about the illegitimacy of his rule. Those who have helped you to become the head of the Muslim state have done a big disservice to Islam and will soon know what awaits them.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The moon of Muharram, times of sadness.
As-salamu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
إنما خرجت لطلب الإصلاح في أمة جدي صلى الله عليه وآله.
The words of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in dialogue. a special program for the month of Muharram.
Sallallahu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Casting gloom on Karbala.
Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the son of the Lady of Light, the Honorable Fatima, the son of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali, the grandson of the Noble Prophet Muhammad. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the beacon of light which guides towards knowledge and wisdom, the one who has eloquently said, O people, the person who is generous becomes a grand, lofty person. The person who is stingy debases himself. Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, the master of martyrs, these are his dialogues. Imam al-Husayn's words in response to Abdullah bin al-Zubayr.
قال الإمام الحسين عليه السلام إن أبي حدثني أن بمكة كبشا به تستحل حرمتها فما أحب أن أكون ذلك الكبش ولئن أقتل خارجا منها بشبر أحب إلي من أن أقتل فيها ولئن أقتل خارجا منها بشبرين أحب إلي من أن أقتل خارجا منها بشبر وأيم الله لو كنت في جحر هامة من هذه الهوام يستخرجوني حتى يقضوا بي حاجتهم والله لا يعتدن علي كما اعتدت اليهود في السبت يا ابن الزبير لئن أدفن بشط الفرات أحب إلي من أن أدفن بفناء الكعبة إن هذا يقول لي كن حماما من حمام الحرم ولئن أقتل وبيني وبين الحرم باع أحب إلي من أن أقتل وبيني وبينه شبر ولئن أقتل بالطف أحب إلي من أن أقتل بالحرم إن هذا ليس شيء من الدنيا أحب إليه من أن أخرج من الحجاز وقد علم أن الناس لا يعدلونه بي فود أني خرجت حتى يخلو له.
My father reported that there would be a ram at Mecca whose honor would be desecrated. Hence, I never liked to be that ram. And if I get slain out of it by a span, it is more desirable for me to get slain inside Mecca. And if I get slain out of it by two spans, it is more desirable to me than getting slain in it by a span. By Allah, had I been in the burrow of a small animal like these animals, they would draw me out until they do with me their job. By Allah, they will assault me as the Jews did on Saturday. O Ibn al-Zubayr, if I am buried on the riverbank of the Euphrates, it will be more desirable to me than being buried within the precinct of the Kaaba. This person, Abdullah bin al-Zubayr, has been suggesting to me, be one of the doves of the haram, and if I get slain, while the distance between me and the haram is by a fathom, it would be more desirable to me than getting slain, and the distance between me and the haram is by a span. And if I get slain at Al-Taf, it would be more desirable to me than getting slain within the haram. there is nothing in the world more desirable to him, Abdullah bin al-Zubayr, than that I leave Hijaz. And he has realized that people would not regard him equal with me. Therefore, he wishes for me to depart here until they get around him.
Karbala! As I step onto your sand, you capture my eyes. Karbala! I see heaven has been placed here beneath your skies.
And now let's listen to Dr. Muhammad Reza Fakhr al-Ruhani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Vinasta'in. Sallallahu alayki ya Aba Abdullah. When Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam intended to leave Mecca, Abdullah ibn Zubayr came forward and tried to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Of course, Abdullah ibn Zubayr wasn't that faithful in approaching Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Simply, he wanted to discourage Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. However, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam's answer reveals many points. First of all, in that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was well informed of the point that an innocent personality was determined to be killed in Mecca, and Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam didn't want to be that person, because by doing so, the Umayyad agents in Mecca would certainly degrade the honor of the city of Mecca, due to which, I mean, its honor shouldn't be breached. And at the same time, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that he was determined not to cause any dishonor to be done regarding the city of Mecca and Al-Kaaba over there. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that he was sure that the Umayyad agents were resolute to kill him, and compared them with the Jews who on one Saturday killed many prophets over there, I mean, in the community. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated it in this way, that he wanted to be buried near the river banks of the Euphrates, rather than to be buried in the vicinity of Al-Kaaba. Al-Kaaba is very much important, and because it's the Qibla in the Muslim community. However, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam never intended that the honor of Al-Kaaba be breached. Because of this, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that he wanted to be buried in the vicinity of the river Euphrates in Iraq. And here we find that Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam refers to Karbala by way of indicating, for example, Shat al-Furat, the river banks of the Euphrates, or Ataf, designations of Al-Furat. And then Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam indicated that he was very much informed of the point that Abdullah ibn Zubayr wasn't that sincere in his suggestion to him not to leave Mecca. Rather, Abdullah ibn Zubayr, as historical records indicate, he wasn't on the side of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. He wanted to be the ruling power of Mecca. So he wanted Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to remain in Mecca in order to be caught and slain by the Umayyad agents over there. Despite Abdullah ibn Zubayr's suggestions, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was too clever to be deceived by his suggestion. Rather, Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam regarded it the best choice to continue his movement and to leave Mecca for Al-Kufa in Iraq. Sallallahu alayk, ya Aba Abdullah.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Dialogue. We hope that you remain under the auspicious grace of Imam Hussein today and always.
last vestiges of the American presence in Afghanistan departed the Kabul airport in late August, an end to an occupation that cost thousands of lives and ended with a complete takeover in the country by the group the Americans spent two decades fighting. The so-called war on terrorism, on the other hand, has been a catastrophe, with the best of intentions or the worst. American military leaders had set a deadline of August 31st, but they had to leave even sooner after a terrorist attack on the airport killed 13 U.S. service members and as many as 170 civilians. A bitter reminder of the Americans' failure in Afghanistan, a country known as the Graveyard of Empires.
What we've done, how we got into that mess is just amazing, but we could have gotten out with honor, and we should have gotten out with honor, and instead, we got out with the exact opposite of honor.
In the past few months, the Americans were watching in shame and embarrassment as the Taliban retook Afghanistan at lightning speed. September 11th this year, which will mark the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks, the Taliban flag will be flying over Afghanistan. While the American diplomats have already left the country, and the U.S. Embassy in Kabul will remain closed, according to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. That's while back in July, Blinken had pledged the United States would remain deeply engaged in Afghanistan long after the military left. America's longest war caused so much bloodshed, mostly Afghan blood. According to the costs of war project at Brown University, more than 2,400 U.S. military personnel and nearly 50,000 Afghan civilians died in the 20-year war. The number is estimated by some sources to be up to 200,000. But in terms of its global status, America is much worse off today than when it went to Afghanistan for revenge. The US and its allies rushing to evacuate personnel from Kabul join a long list of the world's greatest powers whose missions in Afghanistan ended in failure.
Afghanistan is called the Graveyard of Empires because a range of major armies, from Alexander the Great to the British Army, actually three major wars, Soviet experience in Afghanistan. It's been very difficult terrain for foreign armies to fight in, but especially to occupy land and territory.
Afghanistan's reputation as a kind of geopolitical quicksand for empires mainly started with the First Anglo-Afghan War, which ended in 1842. The British considered Afghanistan as a vital buffer between its Indian colony and Russia. Fearing the Russians would use Afghanistan to attack South Asia, they moved first, invading in 1839 and installing a local ruler. This ended in what historians dub Britain's greatest imperial disaster, when an army of 4,700 British and Indian soldiers retreating from Kabul was slaughtered nearly to a man. Britain continued trying to incorporate Afghanistan into its empire, fighting two more wars in 1878 and 1919, before ending its ambitions. In 1979, the Soviet Union entered Afghanistan to support the pro-Soviet regime established via a military coup in 1978. It led to a protracted war until 1989, that saw more than 1 million Afghans killed, some in massacres of whole villages by Soviet soldiers. Tens of thousands of Soviets were also injured or killed during the war, which saw Soviet forces clashing with the Mujahideen. The Soviets came to the same conclusion that the British had reached a century earlier. The direct occupation of Afghanistan had a high cost for few benefits, anthropologist Thomas Barfield wrote. Many still consider that the fighting in Afghanistan was integral to the collapse of the Soviet Union. In the words of Raphael Rouvenet, a professor at Indiana University, since the Soviet army was the glue that held the diverse Soviet republics together, its defeat in Afghanistan had profound implications for the survivability of the Soviet Union. The 9/11 attacks drove, this time, the Americans to the quicksand of Afghanistan. The aim was to crush Al-Qaeda and teach the Taliban a lesson for harboring the terrorist group. Within a month, the U.S. began bombing the country, and by December 2001, the Taliban had collapsed, retreating alongside bin Laden into the mountains. But the Taliban's insurgency only gained momentum in the following years, prompting President Barack Obama to increase the U.S. military presence to more than 100,000 troops. Withdrawal plans were delayed as the Taliban gathered strength all the while. It turned into fierce violence under President Donald Trump, who agreed to withdraw U.S. troops from the country in a February 2020 peace deal. Aware of domestic exhaustion at the so-called Forever War, Trump's successor, Joe Biden, moved on, announcing that the U.S. would leave by the end of August. Experts will long debate how and where the U.S. got it so wrong. Romain Malijak, the author of Warlord Survival, about state building in Afghanistan, argues, like other powers before, the U.S. mistakenly believed it could remake the country using force. Afghanistan is particularly hard to conquer, mainly due to the intersection of three factors. First, because Afghanistan is located on the mainland route between Iran, Central Asia, and India, it has been invaded many times and settled by a great number of tribes, many mutually hostile to each other and outsiders. Second, because of the frequency of invasion and the prevalence of tribalism in the area, its lawlessness led to a situation where almost every village was built like a fortress. Third, the physical terrain of Afghanistan makes conquest and rule extremely difficult. Afghanistan is dominated by some of the highest and more jagged mountains in the world. These include the Hindu Kush, which dominates the country and runs through the center and south of the country. In a national address, U.S. President Joe Biden strongly backed his exit policy from Afghanistan, saying he has ended America's longest war after 20 long years of bloodshed.
You have to be honest. Our mission in Afghanistan has taken many missteps, made many missteps over the past two decades. I'm now the fourth American president to preside over war in Afghanistan, two Democrats and two Republicans. I will not pass this responsibility on to a fifth president. I will not mislead the American people by claiming that just a little more time in Afghanistan will make all the difference.
All in all, only time will tell whether the old saying about Afghanistan being the graveyard of empires proves as true for America as it did for the Soviet Union. America's retreat from Afghanistan is at least as humiliating as the Soviets' withdrawal in 1989, an event that precipitated the end of its empire. Both withdrew as losers.